Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Piers, for inviting me. Yeah, you just spoiled my first joke. I was about to say, for those who don't know me, I'm not Brian Maple, but I'm Priscilla Rosen, and I'm going to talk about how we can experimentally tune the ground state of barium and iron to arsenic 2 by ARCO differentiation. This work was mostly done in the University of Campinas in Brazil, where I was a PhD student under the supervision of Professor Pascoal Paluzzo, in collaboration with the University of California. Yeah, I know, they look pretty similar. Here in California, Irvine, where I'm now a postdoc under the supervision of Zachary Fisk. So this is the iron arsenic team. I'm going to talk about a lot of works and all those people were involved. In the first line, you can see the sample growers. We are all alive, although we have grown more than 500 arsenic single crystals. Professor Chris Adriano, Thales Garitezi, Pascoal Paluzzo, me, and Zach Fisk. Eduardo Granado and Eduardo Vitar, they are in the synchrotron doing the X-ray absorption measurements. Ricardo Urbano is our NMR guy, and Ted Grant did almost all the scanning microscope measurements. He's, well, very big Angels fan. I don't know if you follow baseball, but he's pretty sad that they lost 2 days ago. And I have to acknowledge a really, really good companion during my ESR measurements too, which is Sheldon Cooper here, his bubblehead here. So the outline of my talk, first, I know you all know about the iron nictides, but I'm gonna give a little flavor of the motivation why we wanna study them. I'm gonna talk an alternative single crystal growth that we made based on indium flux technique and some microscopic properties. Then I'm gonna spend more time in the microscopic investigation by both X-ray absorption spectroscopy and electron spin resonance, and finally the conclusions. So first of all, we have a huge variety of families of iron-based superconductors, from the 1-1s to the 1111 and the more complicated ones, all layered materials. And the thing here that I wanna talk about is that first, they have a common structural parameter, which is the iron arsenic tetrahedra, and the common electronic parameter, which is the spin density wave magnetic instability. And I want to know how they are correlated. Right? So we should start with, from the experimental point of view, with materials which have a good sample quality and a variety of compounds that you can study. And to do that, we start with the 1-2-2s, barium iron 2, arsenic 2, by both electrons. Well, I'm going to talk about this, but cobalt, nickel, copper substitution in the iron side, or potassium and manganese, or potassium, sorry. And the barium side, you can induce superconductivity, not with manganese. And also, you can induce superconductivity under pressure. So the first thing that one can ask is that how we can relate this iron-based superconductors to other unconventional superconductors. And I want to start by saying that heavy fermion superconductors, they are also layered superconductors. If you start with, for example, a very famous one with blocks of cerium indium-3 separated by transition metal indium-2, you have the 115s, and if you take the transition metal as rhodium, it is an antiferromagnetic compound which can be tuned to a superconducting state by both iridium and cobalt substitution, and also under pressure. If you take the high TC superconductors, also you have layered structures. You have a close relation to magnetism, although in this case you have a mock insulator. And you cannot induce superconductivity to the parent compound and the pressure, but if it is already a superconductor, you can slightly increase TC. So, with the first question in mind, how can we relate the magnetic phase to structural parameters, right? And the curious thing is that you can naively scale TC in the heavy fermion superconductors with the ratio between the lattice parameters C and A. They linearly scale. Concerning the cube rates, you can also have a very simple scale if you have good eyes with the copper oxygen apical distance and TC. And you can ask yourself, what about the iron arsenides in this scenario? If you plot TC against C over A, you see that the ironicides are in between. They're roughly linearly scaled. And the interesting thing here is that MgB2 and the boron carbide, they're way too far in this graph. So I'm tempted to say that first, the two-dimensional character is something that is propitious to the emergence of superconductivity. But you can ask yourself, what about the ironicides themselves? Here you have huge error bars, and they do not scale linearly like the heavy fermion superconductors. So we want to know what's the tuning structural parameter in this case. But first, we have to have good single crystals, right? And a technique that we usually use to get single crystals is the flux technique. I'm sure you all heard about it, but just real quickly, I'm gonna go through it. You have a quartz tube with a crucible inside, and then you have your elements in the beginning. You have a thermal profile where you heat those elements to a maximum temperature, where you have a saturated solution with a low melting point element, then you slowly cool it down to grow the single crystals, and you can remove it at the temperature that is higher than the melting point of your flux. This is a very good technique because it provides low temperature of synthesis, well-defined morphology, less thermal stress, and then you take your quartz tube, you invert it, you can use a centrifuge to remove the excess flux. And just to be sure, this is not a toilet bowl. That could be a really, really wrong confusion in the lab. But the thing is that to grow ironicides in the literature, there are some current disadvantages. If you use tin as a flux, you can have tin incorporation, and the transition temperatures can change. If you have the self-flux technique, iron arsenic technique, using these elements in excess, you possibly can have non-stoichiometric 1-2 compounds, right? So we want to develop a new technique without those disadvantages. And of course, I don't want to be exposed to a lot of arsenic in my life. And so we developed a method using indium flux, and we can have huge, beautiful single crystals. This is actually the largest one, of course. And some of them have really nice S-grown faces, and the stoichiometric compound is in a very good 1-2 ratio without any indium incorporation. So the first thing that we performed was diffraction measurements to make sure that we had the right phase and the right transition temperatures. And the first thing that strikes us is that as we cool down the system, we first have a tetragonal, well-defined peak at 140 Kelvin. But as you lower one lowers the temperature, you have a coexistence transition here, where you have both tetragonal peaks and orthorhombic peaks. So even for the undoped compound, we have a coexistence between a tetragonal paramagnetic phase and an orthorhombic magnetic one. We're going to see in a couple of minutes that this is the case for microscopic probes too, like NMR. Also, we can measure the resistivity of the sample and compare it with other methods. And we see that for our crystals with indium flux, we have first lower residual resistivity and higher triple R's or comparable triple R's. Also, if we measure magnetic susceptibility around the transition, around 140 Kelvin, and also heat capacity, we see that both transitions also appear. The first one with low entropy is the structural one, and the large one with larger entropy is the magnetic one. We didn't publish that yet, but we are collaborating with Rafael Fernandez to understand this. And as far as we know so far, is that this entropy balance here is related to the out-of-plane anisotropy of the iron grid bands. And you're going to see that exactly what we see with the other methods. So I know I'm talking about macroscopic properties, but just a hint about the NMR technique. We measure the arsenic NMR signal. Here you have a really sharp line, which is the half minus half transition. And for the tin samples, we have three peaks, meaning disorder. But for the indium flux samples, we have a really, really sharp one. I'm not going to show the coexistence for the pure compound because the data is not published yet, but I can show the one for the cobalt sample. I can assure you it's the same, just like 0.01 doping of cobalt, and you see the coexistence here of the tetragonal paramagnetic line and the orthorhombic magnetic one. Also, you can ask yourself, well, what about doping, right? If we dope on the iron side with several transition metals from cobalt to ruthenium and nickel, you see that except for the ruthenium one, which is here, all the other ones have higher transition temperatures comparing to the cell flux ones. I know that one Kelvin difference cannot mean very much, but it actually does for samples which are, as the title of this conference says, bad metals, right? Oh, and we have the complete phase diagram for the cobalt substitution.
Can you see coexistence?
Yes, we can. We can. Okay. Another thing that we asked ourselves was what happens with TC under pressure? And surprisingly, what we see is that for nearly optimally doped samples of several transition metal substitutions, of course, manganese is not superconductor, but all the other ones were nearly the OPD region, we see that for cobalt and nickel, the increase is slight, as one would expect for nearly all OPD samples. But for copper, the increase is almost 2.5 times. And it was surprising in the beginning, but then we measured electron spin resonance in the samples, and we could see, I'm going to talk about ESR later, but just to make my point here, if you have a paramagnetic probe, you have, or a local moment, you have an ESR signal, an unpaired electron. And only for the case of manganese and copper, you could see the signal. Meaning that in this case, you are actually substituting iron by a local moment. That's why you cannot see superconductivity in the manganese samples and why TC is so low in the copper samples. But under pressure, you can actually hybridize the copper electrons, local electrons, and increase TC drastically.
So do you have measurements for this increase of TC, for example, doped, for example, with cobalt that corresponds to the same electronic doping to the one in copper? Because well, there you have the same substitution, but the electronic doping is different in each of the compounds.
Well, first, I'm going to show in the next slide, I guess, or in three slides, that from our measurements, we see that cobalt and copper, they are not effectively introducing chargers to the system. But if you want to think like this, we are taking the same concentration of dopings in all the cases. I'm not
using
counting
the same concentration of atoms.
Yeah, I'm not counting the electrons.
Why you say that they are not introducing effectively carriers into the?
Yeah, I'm gonna get there. Okay, so from these measurements, we can say that there is a magnetic pair breaking mechanism in the ironic tides, and they are due to local moments of copper and manganese. That's why superconductivity is so different in both of them. So now I'm going to talk about the microscopic investigation. And the first thing that we have made was X-ray absorption spectroscopy. Just a brief review: when you have photon energy below 40 keV, you have a mechanism that is dominated by photoelectron emission. So when the photon goes in the sample, one of the core shell electrons is removed, so you have this huge absorption. But this photoelectron can be seen as a spherical wave, and this spherical wave can be can interact with the neighbors, and you can see the structure, destructive and constructive interference as you scan the energy or the wavelength. So depending on the distance to the nearest atoms, you have a different pattern here, right? So this is a really, really microscopic technique that can help you understand the distance between atoms in a crystal. And well, you have, of course, the Beer law, where you have exponential decay with thickness. For exhaust measurement, you can remove the background for an isolated atom, which is mu naught, and you can have then the what we call the exhaust spectrum chi. So we perform exhausts in the arsenic K edge in transmission mode for three different samples: the pure compound, the compound doped with cobalt, and the one doped with potassium, which in the beginning we thought it could be electron and hole doping. So here we plot the Fourier transform of that function. So as a function of R, we see really well-defined distances here: the arsenic iron distance and the arsenic barium or potassium distance. And the striking thing is that if you compare cobalt and potassium, the distance, the iron arsenic distance, decreases for both dopings, independent of the electron or hole doping. So that's the first evidence that we don't have actual doping. We are seeing a distortion in the lattice due to the substitution.
Sir, not familiar with the exhaust. So how does exactly the exhaust signal relate to the bond distance?
So you actually have to do a fit using the Fermi-Golden rule and then extract the distance from the function chi. It's not easy to...
But should I think of this as sort of the interference pattern and therefore it depends on distance, or is it purely sort of LDA? So what comes into the modeling? You model the actual realistic structure with some bond length?
Yes, exactly.
Then the statement
with one scattering from the nearest neighbor.
Okay.
Without multiple scattering.
Right, but in the end, the Fermi-Golden rule directly doesn't care about the bond lengths, right? It's just density of states that enters. So is your statement that the varying bond lengths somehow influences density of states that in turn influences the exact signal?
No, it's not the density of states. It's the actual distance. From the formula, you can extract the distance. We can discuss that later.
Okay.
Just to kind of, I'm not understanding, because everything can be local in an atom, right? So mm-hmm. there's some structure back in an atom, it's just different distance between the atoms that give me the interference pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's
yeah.
what I asked, but that's what.
Yeah, I think
that's what it is.
I think that's all.
Exactly. It's just an interference pattern in the end.
But I thought that the final structure, they're always sensitive to energy. So unlike X-ray, you're not probing the actual diffraction.
Well, but energy and wavelength, you can use either one. And then from energy, you can perform a Fourier transform and see the distances as a function of R, right?
So is the raw single angle dependent then? So when you do transmission, it's in transmission mode, do you get a signal as a function of angle?
No.
Okay.
What we get is this expression here. And then you can model the absorption coefficient.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can I ask a question about the distance? So is this the same statement as this angle being optimized as you approach optimal
quite.
TC, or is it? It's a different statement.
It's a different one.
Yeah, because also the height and the lattice parameter will change.
Yeah.
So but it's part of the factors at the AAS distances.
Yeah, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the iron arsenic distance changes much less than the height and wake up beam itself. So in some sense, if you also plot in the same way A and H, the two parameters.
No, I agree, usually it's a height that changes.
The height changes of an order of magnitude more, and the same
I understand,
A.
But
it's different. You can think about the angle, but here it doesn't mean that the angle is optimal when it's OPD.
That's fine, but I'm just trying to understand the significance of this statement. Why do I care about this distance?
Okay, you're going to see in a minute.
But okay, maybe I missed it, but okay, here you're showing that it goes in the same direction for both probing, it's very direct to say that carriers don't go in the...
Yeah, I agree totally with you. That's why we perform Zanes with cobalt temperature.
Okay.
Yeah.
Am I right that changes with temperature are at least comparable to changes with dose? Looking at this.
Yeah, they also decrease decrease with temperature. That's
so
true.
Even if you don't change doping, the distance of change with temperature are pretty much in the same amount as the full talk about dosage.
I wouldn't say that. They decrease less with temperature than with
39.5.
Yeah, but you have to compare the compounds at the same temperature to see what's the distance doing to their properties, right?
Right. Then you expect that the same type of changes will be with temperature.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next, and also, besides cobalt and potassium substitution, what we see is that under pressure, always also the distance decreases. So So it seems that they are correlated. The decrease of the spin density wave transition and the structural parameter D.
That's like the problem, right?
Yes.
And this is a much larger change.
Yeah, they are.
Order of magnitude.
But, well, yeah, but you're performing a much larger perturbation in this system too. Okay, so about your question. So we can think that, okay, we're changing the distance because we are introducing carriers, although the pressure also does the same thing. We want to be sure that it's not introducing actual carriers to the system. So we first studied cobalt substitution, several substitutions, and in this case, what we can see here is not exabs, it's zanes, meaning that it's near the absorption edge, either way. And here you see the absorption coefficient as a function of energy, and when you compare all the dopings, there's absolutely no shift in the iron K edge absorption. If there were more carriers, you would see a shift here. That's for sure. And there is none. So that made us infer and conclude that for cobalt, you don't see any other carriers introduced to the system. Okay. So the next microscopic property is electron spin resonance. So just an overview for a very simple spin half system, you can apply magnetic field and lift the Zeeman degeneracy. And if you apply a microwave photon, you can induce a transition to the higher state with the absorption of microwave, and for technical reasons, we use a locking detection, so we see actually the first derivative of the absorption. In the case of metals, you have dispersion and absorption, so you don't have a Lorentzian line, but a Daisonian line instead. And if you think about the relaxation of this excited spin, which is the local moment, it can relax to the lattice or to the heat bath or to the conduction electrons that are gonna ultimately go to the lattice too. But in our case, we have local spins which are in general S spins, meaning that they have only J equals 7/2 in the case of europium, but no local moment, L equals zero, or there's quench of the angular momentum for the transition metal case. So in this case, we don't have this relaxation here, since we don't have coupling between the local moments and the lattice. And I'm going to show that there is no bottleneck effect, meaning that for the case of iron, there's a considerable spin orbit coupling. So this thing here happens much faster than this. So you can ignore this too. So we are interested in this relaxation here of our electrons, meaning that we have a relaxation of the local spins to the conduction electrons. And we can consider a spin flip mechanism, which was derived by Coringa a long, long time ago. And you have your local spins here, and they can relax through the flipping of a conduction electron. And if you use, you can use the Fermi-Golden rule again, and now you're going to have to believe me, but after the calculations, you see that this relaxation here, it's beautifully linear with temperature. And this coefficient B here, which is the Coringa rate, is proportional to the density of states, to the average of the exchange interaction. And also, if you have electron-electron correlations, you have to add these terms here. Also, the G value, which is the variation between the G value or the resonance field, you can think of both. The difference with the insulating value is also proportional to the density of state.
What's the A term?
The alpha term?
The constant term. Why is that constant term?
This one here?
No. Well, the T. I thought Corinne has linear in T.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're thinking about NMR. In this case, you don't have inhomogeneous component to your relaxation. In the case of ESR, you measure both homogeneous and inhomogeneous component, so you have a residual line width. So that's the term A.
Is it usually large, or is it?
Well, it depends. Well, in the case of these compounds, they have magnetism, so it's for sure higher than zero. But we're not gonna have to deal with it because I'm gonna talk about the paramagnetic response above the transition, the magnetic transition temperature. So I'm gonna be more concerned with this term here.
Priscilla, experimentally, how do you extract one over T and C? Is it the width of the ESR?
Yeah, exactly. Because the in all the resonance phenomena, right, the inverse of the relaxation time is proportional to the line width. So this is the line width.
Right, but then looking at the raw data, I mean, it's not a beautiful Lorentzian. So how do you actually do you just take full width at half maximum?
No, there's a theory to fit the data, the Bisonian theory. So we have ways to fit the data.
Okay.
So the first thing, how's my time going? Okay, it's gonna be fast. So the first thing that we thought about was, okay, let's start with the magnetic series first, right? No superconductivity, let's just see how the magnetism evolves from the europium iron two arsenic two compound to the barium one. Why europium? Because you need to have a paramagnetic probe, right, to do ESR. So here's the evolution of the specific heat in the series. I don't have time to go through all the details, but the important thing here is that we can fit all the data with a Kihi-Weiss law plus a Pauli term, chi naught, and chi naught is the same for all compounds. So this means that alpha, the enhancement, the stoner enhancement factor, is the same along the series. We also have the resistivity and the phase diagram. It's important to note that we started with the thin flux here because, well, in the beginning we didn't have the indium grow samples, so we had to start with the thin grow ones. Okay. And then we performed ESR in all the compounds, and what we see here, remember the linear term? It's there. For almost the pure compound, the europium pure compound, we have a pretty generous Coringa rate of 6, but it decreases as we decrease the content of europium. In this case here, with 20% europium, the Coringa rate is already 3.5. But within the experimental errors, the G values are almost the same. So from our calculations first, we have first that the G value is the same. We know that alpha is the same. So that means that within the error bar, for all the series, the density of states is the same. For this compound, it's not so much as a shock because barium is 2 plus and europium is 2 plus, so one wouldn't expect any changes. But we're going to see that for all the superconducting ones, this is also the case. And also, the Coringa rate decreases, right? So as we know, this term here is constant, this term here is constant, so this means that the average J of K is decreasing along the series, right? So, but what the heck does that mean? To understand that, I have to go real quickly through this slide about the importance of the crystal field in the ionic tides. So in this case, we don't have a regular tetrahedral symmetry because alpha 1 is different from alpha 2. So we have a split of the T2 EG doublets and T2G orbitals, as we can see here. And from what we are expecting from our data is we can say that the distance between iron and arsenic is changing this splitting here. And from DFT plus DMFT calculations of the Fermi surface, we see that indeed the triplet orbitals are at the Fermi surface, and the XY orbital around gamma is the one we are interested in now. So, okay, having said that, we can understand the decrease of the Coringa rate and the decreasing average of JFS as a change in the orbital character at the Fermi surface. How? Well, the JFS of K is only the Fourier transform of the especially varying exchange interaction in R, right? So if the average decreases, this means that this function is oscillating faster, meaning that it's becoming, the 3D bands are more anisotropic or less S-like, and are in average, since the J, the exchange parameter, is proportional to the overlap between the 4F European bands and the 3D bands at the Fermi surface. This mean that the 3D bands are becoming, in average, further away from the European side. I know it's, are you following me? And this means that the planar orbital character, the planar XY character, is increasing in the Fermi surface. Okay. So if we go back to that picture, we see that this orbital here, XY, should decrease in the iron compound. Why? Because here is the European one, right? It's a whole pocket, so it's a large pocket. If the XY orbital occupation is increasing, what would you expect? That this band is gonna go down a little bit because the occupation is increasing, right? And that's exactly what RPC, comparing European and Baryon, the pockets around gamma are much larger in European than in Baryon. Okay? So in a very pictorial view, we can say that with a decreasing in the iron arsenic distance, we have an interplay between the orbital characters at the Fermi surface. So the XZ, YZ orbitals decrease and the XY orbital increases. You're not changing the density of states because you still have 3D6 iron orbitals, right? But the change of occupation between them can happen.
So the two other small hole pockets should increase in size. That's what you are saying.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence in our that there is this distribution between
It's not so clear. No.
Not so clear means
that there are other changes in the other ones, but they are all mixed together.
No, we're only talking about hole pockets. Right now we're talking about what happens to the node.
Okay. Now what, can you?
Well, the question was if XY firm surface shrinks in size, mm-hmm. would the other smaller hole pockets increase in size? Should we see this as evidence now?
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. But from the data I got in the literature, they do not say that. And for me, it's complicated to see from this picture. But I agree with you because the density of states is the same.
But your implication from your CU data, Priscilla, would be that what? That the XY pocket grows? Is that correct?
Grows in for Europium.
For Europium.
Meaning that it decreases the occupancy of the XY pocket in the European case.
Decreases and increases.
No, yeah, it's the opposite because it's a hole pocket.
Well, okay, depends what you call the occupancy. The number of holes increases, right? Therefore, the pocket grows.
Yeah, the size of the pocket increases. But if the size increases, it means that this band here goes up here, so it's less occupied.
Yes, yeah, that I understand.
Okay.
Sorry, with Europium, you have a more elongated tetrahedra or a more squashed tetrahedra?
In Europium?
Yeah.
The height is larger, so
okay.
A more elongated one. And we didn't do exams for Europium, to be honest. But from the literature, we know that the height, this height here, is larger for Europium, meaning that the distance is higher too. I won't have time to finish. Oh, and this is in agreement with the FT plus the MFT calculations. With decreasing iron arsenic distance, you also have an increase of the XY occupation. So that's.
With electron pockets, you also have maybe some organization. So which is the and you have XY and YZ and ZX pockets.
Yeah, but they are all mixed together. It's really hard to say anything about it.
Yeah, but probably the occupation in the electron pockets is also changing. So just to look at the whole pockets. Probably, it's like if one only see the electron pocket, how can one be sure what's happening to the total occupation?
Well, because we have from the ESR data, we know that the density of states is not changing, right?
No, I mean between the different orbits.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. You can see that the planar. The XY character is increasing from the ESR data. And it you can look at the Fermi surface and see that that's the case, too. Okay.
Are we sure that the ESR really gives us density of states, gives us really climb? And so you might find your Fermi liquid parameters are changing. Compensate for the change in the size of the Fermi surface.
Which parameter?
So you're not directly measuring the density of quasi-particle states using the ESR, because you're measuring susceptibility.
Yeah.
So there might be a different Stoner enhancement factor mm-hmm. coming in there. How can you be sure that that's not?
Yeah, if you have a very different Stoner factor, or Stoner enhancement factor, you would expect that the effective mass would be really different between both to account for the huge difference in Coringa rate we see, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have performed quantum, thanks for your question, by the way. We have performed quantum oscillations in the Europe.
Okay, and what happened?
And it's nice because like it's the first time that one sees the oscillations in this compound because of the sample quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so here are the oscillations. They are really modest, but they are there. If you subtract a fourth order polynomial fit, we can see the oscillations pretty well. Mm-hmm. And all the pockets are really similar, gamma and the second harmonic beta and alpha and delta pockets. Gamma and delta are electron pockets, and alpha is a hole pocket, right? So they're pretty similar, as one would expect, because the Fermi surfaces are similar.
But we think the size of Fermi surfaces changes between
them. They are.
Apparently, can really track.
Yeah, but I'm gonna get there. But that doesn't mean that they're really drastically changing, because they have pretty similar structures, pretty similar lattice parameters, and the same density of states, right? So they cannot change a lot. The changes are subtle, actually. Okay. So if we extract the effective masses, one can see that going from baryon to europium, they are like almost the same. I made the calculations to see if this change, this little change in effective mass, could account for that change in the Coringa rate, and they can't. And just to be sure, the effective masses from our measurements are pretty similar to the ones in the literature too. Okay? So there is another thing that is driving the different spin density wave transition temperature in both compounds. Yeah? Oh, means you have holes. Which is okay, because alpha is a hole pocket. No, DFT tells me that it is a hole pocket. Quantum oscillations cannot tell me the sign. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Priscilla, and one more question. So from this table, it would seem that the frequency of the alpha pocket actually decreases in your opinion.
Yeah, I was really disappointed with that too. But the thing is that was the ferromagnetic regime. We have a reconstructed Fermi surface here now, and they could be all mixed.
Oh wait, so this was anti-ferromagnetic regime?
Yeah, that's the thing. That we were performing ESR in the paramagnetic regime, ARPIS in the paramagnetic regime, so we could see the changes in the Fermi surface really clearly. In the magnetic state, everything changes. We cannot have much information there, unfortunately. I completely agree with you, but that's an easy way to talk with DFT. That's all. I agree, it's a reconstructed Fermi surface. Okay. And so we have to try to understand the differences with something else, right? Because the effective masses and the frequencies are pretty much the same. And strikingly, the angular dependence of the frequency changes a lot. Here it's baryon 1-2, and you have pretty 2D cylinder responses, 1 over cosine of alpha. And in the European case, they're almost constant, meaning that in this case you have a fairly 3D pocket, and here you have a 2D pocket. So this is anisotropic, and this is isotropic, exactly as ESR was telling us, right? You have here almost all the orbitals at the Fermi surface with the same weight. And here you have more XY at the Fermi surface. So this becomes more anisotropic and 2D, right? And this was submitted recently to PRB, and we were fighting with the referee because they wanted us to do DFT calculations, and well, we have to agree with the referee sometimes. And we have performed DFT calculations with Michel Johannes, and actually we can see just by visual inspection that the Fermi sheet at the baryon 1-2 are much more 2D. Of course there's some anisotropy, but they are much more 2D than the European ones.
And that's the reconstructed Fermi surface?
Yeah. And it's shifted too. We have to do some shifts to improve the agreement with theory and calculations. But yeah, it's the reconstructed one. But of course, we can also have a quantitative analysis, which is this number here, R, which is the ratio between the frequency at 0 degrees and the frequency at 90 degrees. And what one can see is that the anisotropy ratio is higher in the barium 1 to 2 for all the pockets. So we are, everything is in agreement. I don't have time for this. I just want to say that besides the magnetic series, we also, this is going to be very confusing, we also doped iron with a lot of transition metals to see if that's the case for the superconducting samples too. So here's all the ESR resonances. For copper and manganese, we have the resonance as we were expecting from a local moment. And what we can see here is that going from the 20% europium sample, barium 0.8, europium 0.2, iron 2, silicon 2, arsenic 2, and when we substitute iron by all the transition metals, we have always a decrease of the Korriger rate. And amazingly, the transition temperature roughly scales with the Korriger rate. Well, ruthenium is a little bit more complicated, but the result is, the main result is that the Korriger rate decreases with the decreasing transition temperature. But if you are probing the out-of-plane europium, and if the orbitals are becoming more XY, you would expect this decrease. But what if the probe is in the iron-arsenic plane? You would expect the opposite to happen, right? Because if they are becoming more planar, the overlap is increasing, and then the Korriger rate has to increase. And that's exactly what we see when the probe is in the plane. Here is the pure compound. When you dope with manganese, you decrease the transition temperature, and you have a Korriger rate of 1. But if you dope with copper, and this actually is superconducting, you have a decrease of the transition temperature going to 0, actually, and the Korriger rate increases. The opposite happens. Oh, and this actually is going to be published tomorrow. So, but if you want to see it, I can give you a sneak peek. Okay, so the conclusion is that we have grown high-quality single crystals by the indium flux technique. We observed that a decrease of the iron-arsenic distance happens as we suppress the spin density wave order by both chemical substitution, cobalt and potassium, and applied pressure. And we also have observed that the iron 2 plus valence does not change by cobalt substitution. We have similar critical temperatures independent of the chemical substitution of choice, because they all result in the same local distortion, except of course for copper and manganese, because they have local moments. And finally, we have a magnetic phase suppression, which causes an increase of the planar orbital contribution to the Fermi surface. Just to finish, we can say that local distortions plus the planar contribution to the Fermi surface they both result in the magnetic phase suppression and the right symmetry of fluctuations at the Fermi surface. And these two combined give us the emergence of superconductivity. Thank you very much. Not yet, but we are planning on doing that soon.
Do you know whether the indium flux method has improved your superconducting TC?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was really quick, but. So here in the inset, we have a comparison between indium flux growth and self flux growth. And except for ruthenium, because we didn't optimize that yet, all the other ones, we got higher TCs. And under pressure, we got, this is also not published yet, but oh, I can say, we got 30 Kelvin superconductivity, which is higher than any other in the literature.
The really big increase for the copper, the Fermi copper.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of Kelvin increase maybe.
Yeah.
And the transition remains sharp. So you measure TC by a point where it's
mm-hmm.
Bristol? So given that the SANAS gives you somewhat counterintuitive results, right, that the iron valence doesn't seem to change upon cobalt doping,
mm-hmm.
do you think it would be possible to do a cross-check by using, for example, hard XPS, hard X-ray for the emission spectroscopy, another technique that can probe the valence of iron?
Mm-hmm. But I would say that Zanes would be the most reliable one in this case.
I mean, could it be that somehow it only probes the shells very close to the iron? So in other words, once the d orbitals become delocalized and farther away from the nucleus,
yeah, but
the SANAS doesn't quite capture
it. If it was at the Fermi surface, the technique would give a shift, for sure. That means that what we think is happening is that the extra electron is at the cobalt side. Is not at the Fermi surface, is within the Muffington ratio of cobalt.
I see.
Which implies that the changes seen in the size of the pockets are due to local changes of water energy.
Exactly, it's because of the changes. Just a sec. The changes at the Fermi surface are due to the changes at the iron arsenic distance, which changes the crystal field configuration for this material.
So should we expect also just changing the transmuter, even if we don't change the crystal field, we expect changes in the orbital content of the pocket, and that some pockets can be larger, and in particular when you elevate the transmuter, you expect that you have more extra. That's something that's. It's not necessarily only the crystal field, but the whole thing has changed.
Can I just ask a question about this local chemistry and all that?
Mm-hmm.
So you said that optimal superconductivity, the angle may not necessarily be the perfect angle, but from the systematics you've looked at, would you say something about this iron arsenic distance sort of providing some role in optimizing the TC?
Well, that's a good question. To be honest, I don't know the answer. Just by looking at the periodic table, I couldn't say what would be the distance, right? But what we know is that if you take a parent compound, and if you decrease the distance,
yeah.
you're gonna suppress the magnetic phase for sure.
Yeah. And what about the superconductivity? Does that benefit or also get suppressed as you do that?
It would benefit because In this case, what, well, this is speculating.
Theoretically, yeah, so you don't know experimentally yet.
No.
That's a question about the ESR. Mm-hmm. You actually observe a Dysonian line shape.
Mm-hmm.
So if I remember well, the ratio A over B depends on the diffusion constant of the electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could extract that, and it should correlate with the resistivity in some way.
But we are in the known diffusive limit. So A over B is almost 2.5.
So my memory fails me there. So if it's 2.5, then the diffusion constant is zero?
Yeah.
I see. And the small a in the line width,
mm-hmm.
you said that was due to some inhomogeneous broadening.
Mm-hmm.
So is there an attempt to saturate the line and to see if pieces disappear if you crack up the field?
Mm-hmm. I didn't do that, actually. I didn't saturate the line.
Because if it's inhomogeneously broadened, then if you increase the intensity of the RF field at a given external field, a piece will, okay.
Yeah, I'll do that.
So are you going to go to the dope samples and see if TC goes up or down
mm-hmm.
with these changes? Okay. Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Priscilla for the presentation.